Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
That's my wife. No worries, not nobody else. My name is Ben. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Iopena meeting in San Juan, Capistrano, California. Thank you, Alberta, for asking. I told him for bring one box Kleenex up here. No more. Thank you, Alberta, for asking me to share and be a part of this convention. As you guys probably know by my last name, I'm a local boy from Hawaii, born and raised. I now live in California, been there for about 8-9 years now. My sobriety date is January 25th, 1989. My mom is the person that got me into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom was on her deathbed, dealing with cancer for 7 years. And I was a full-on alcoholic drug addict living on the streets of Honolulu, running around like a chicken without a head and nowhere to go. And I had ripped off and stole from everybody that I knew because they owed me. I thought the world owed me for what I had gone through in my first 20 years of life. I went to go visit her to get money so I could go back out and go potty. And I went to my mom on her deathbed and asked her for money. And she cried and she told me, you know, your uncle Isaac, he stay in one program called A Second Chance. And the guy running the program, his name was Frank M. And he was my first sponsor. And I told her, yeah, just give me the money. I got to go. 2 days later, I broke back at the same situation I was that day. And I called her back and I said, okay. My uncle and about 5 guys came and did a 12-step call on me. And that was January 24th, 1989. And that was the last day that Ben ever picked up a drink or a drug. And I was 20 years old. I'm the oldest son. I have 2 younger brothers, Eric and Ralph. And it was a pretty brutal upbringing in my eyes at the time. My mom and my dad got divorced when I was about 5 years old. And my dad was an alcoholic. Very abusive physically, emotionally. Spiritually. And my mom also was an alcoholic drug addict herself. And when they got divorced, it just got nuts. And my dad never talked. He yelled. You're freaking key. Da-da-da-da. You good for nothing, you stupid or what? All those lovely words. And that's the kind of upbringing that I had. There wasn't any love. There wasn't any hugs and kisses. And son, I love you. There wasn't any of that. I didn't remember any of that growing up. And my mom met this Marine. And I think that's how they got divorced. So it was part of the reason why. But my mom met a Marine, my stepdad named John, and they just partied. My first drink of alcohol was around 8. My mom and my stepdad had a party over at their house and invited all the Marine friends over and stuff like that. And they would smoke weed every day. And when they would have parties over at the house, for fun, Me and my two younger brothers, they would have us drink tequila shots with lemon and salt. To have us walk around the house drunk at 8 years old. And my brother was 6, and my younger brother was 4. And they would make brownies. Not the kind good brownies, the good brownies. And they would put them out on the table, and we'd go eat, and we'd walk around stone. So from as young as I can remember, alcohol and drugs was always a part of my life. That's all I knew. And abuse. And anger. So I became just like that. I became an alcoholic drug addict just like my parents. And I became abusive just like my dad. And I started to believe the things that my dad used to tell me, that I was stupid and dumb. So from as young as I can remember, I was a special ed student. And I don't know if you know what being special ed is. It's the kids walking out of the stupid class, the dumb class that all the kids used to tease. And I was in that class my entire life growing up until I graduated from high school. So education wasn't high on Ben's priority list. When I became old enough, I started choosing to drink and use on my own without the influence of my parents. And I got molested when I was young, too, by a cousin of mine that I never shared with anybody until I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was the secret that I would take to my grave. And that cousin ended up hanging himself outside of our house when he was 11, 12 years old. And nobody knew nothing about what was going on. Shortly before that, I had lost my grandfather at the airport in front of Hawaiian Airlines. He had his car parked right in front. And me and my cousin just came back from Maui. He even sent us back. And my grandpa had a heart attack and died. And I remember at the funeral, my cousin saying that he wanted to be with grandpa. I didn't know he was going to kill himself. And shortly thereafter, my uncle who raised us, my grandma's brother, he ended up dying too. And nobody taught us kids how to grieve or how to deal with loss. They was dealing with their own grief and their own loss. And we just did what we did. Go play. Grieve on our own. And the abuse just didn't stop. I was the oldest son. So no matter what would happen with my two brothers, I was always responsible. So when I would get lickings from my father, they would get lickings too right after that. And I would make them hurt even worse. I just never seemed to be able to really achieve anything in my first 20 years of life. I didn't know. I didn't want to become really anything. You know? I started this crazy thinking at like 8 years old, 9 years old. I remember, and I dedicate this to my uncle too. Yesterday, we got a call that he was on life support, and we went over to the hospital for say goodbyes because we thought he was going to die. That uncle was a police officer when we was growing up. And when I was 9 years old, I went to go try stealing boogie board from Holiday Mart in Kailua. You guys remember Holiday Mart, Kailua? Well, we used to go there all the time with my mom. And I used to get jealous of all my friends who used to have stuff. So I was like, yeah, I no can get them, I no can buy them. My mother no can buy them, I go steal them. So I went to go watch how they would process big items through the cashier. They would put one bag and one tape on top and walk out the store. So I did that, 9 years old. I'm going to get one Holiday Mart bag and one tape, tape them on the boogie board, walk out the store, put them in my mother's trunk. And I got caught coming back in the store. I shouldn't have went back in the store. But was my Uncle Darwin that when he come to the police station and give me lickings. And he said, you ever do that again, I'm going to kill you. And that's the kind of love we had. Tough love. And that didn't stop me from stealing. I just became smarter. I'm going to come better. I was stealing when I was young. We used to go to, we grew up in Kailua. We used to go to this little store around the corner. We used to walk inside the store, walk out with all kinds of candies. I was stealing from when I was 4, 5, 6 years old. Because we never had nothing. I grew up poor, on welfare. From as long as I can remember, my mother was on welfare. Food stamps, you know the paper food stamps. And because my mother them was daily pot smokers, at the end of the month, when all the money went run out, kind of along 2 weeks into the month, was broke already. No more money. Only had the food stamps for use. So they would send us down in Waimanalo. We was living Humaniki Street in Waimanalo. My mother used to send us down to Shima's. Say, go buy the cheap candy. Bring back all the loose change. Take your brothers with you. So we would do that so that they could get one $10 bag, one $20 bag, so they could get high. Not, oh, go buy cereal, go buy milk, go buy eggs. No, go buy some 5-cent candy and bring the loose change back so I can go buy one bag. That's the kind of upbringing I grew up in. So I was prime ready for Alcoholics Anonymous by the time I came in here at 20. I had 12 years of drinking and using and partying and stealing and abusing my family and stealing from them and beating up my brothers. By 20, I was done. I had nowhere else to go. My grandmother, old school, no lock the door at the house. Anybody can come. That's where Uncle Darwin stay. Anybody can go to that house anytime. Always get one bowl poi on the table. Sardines. Vienna sausage. Corned beef. And you just go inside, go eat. And that's how it was. Well, in my disease, I went my grandma, from as long as I can remember, she worked at the Ilikai Hotel 45 years as a hotel operator. And as long as I can remember, she always used to have one Chinese cat. Was a big one, bro. Big Chinese cat on top the shelf in the living room, in the parlor. And every time she would come, she would only put $0.50 coins and dollar coins inside. Bro, by the time I started tapping that piggy bank, that bugger was full. Used to make this full sound, toink, like right away. As soon as you drop it, toink. By the time Ben went get to him, and by the time she didn't put her next coin in, the team went, tink. Oh, it was gone already. I don't even know how many times I went to take that cat off the shelf into the back room, take out the bottom, shake out enough, we'll go pick up some paper or booze. Whatever, I didn't discriminate when it came to alcohol and drugs. My nickname with my friends in high school was Mr. Bacardi because I love 151. It was the multi-purpose alcohol for me. I couldn't drink beer, I would get sick on beer, but I could drink hard liquor. And that was my thing, man. It didn't matter. It didn't matter what I had, what was there. I was a garbage can. Well, my grandma, as a result of that, told me that I could never come back to that house. She never did that to anybody. And that one went sting. In my disease, as numb as I was, that one went sting. That one hurt grandma. So when Frank and those guys came and did that 12-step call of me, she was the first amends that I'm going to make. And all she told me was, I love you. And just keep doing what you're doing. I went into this program or this clean and sober house by Frank called A Second Chance. And I was the top bunk of my Uncle Isaac. The next day, Frank had one construction job, renovating one of the hotels down here. He said, tomorrow you can go work with the boys. I'll give you a pair of jeans, some boots, a t-shirt, and you can go with them in the morning and go work. They go tell you what to do. Bro, they had me up on the top freaking floor. We went whole bar doing demolition work on one of the, and I'm coming off of alcohol and drugs. They call that detox. That was the old school detox. Today, they don't know what detox is. They go detox Santa, put medication, you know, all this kind of stuff. No, Frank's way, you're going to go work. You're going to work. Oh, I stand there sweating. Oh, like one whole week. That's how I got sober. They take me to the psychiatrist for go get my evaluation so I can get on welfare. The doctor diagnosed me, I don't know, all kinds of stuff. And he would give me one paper. So I go into the van, Frank waiting for me. He said, the doctor ain't give you one paper, one prescription. I said, yeah. He said, give me that. You rip them up. He said, you don't need none of that shit. Thank God he did that. I'd probably be stuck on prescription drugs. Thinking I'm bipolar, schizophrenic, something, you know what I mean? Thank God for that kind of old school sobriety that I got when I first got sober. I don't think I'd be able to get sober today the way things are. I needed that kind of hardcore, straight in your face recovery. And that's what I got. My first meeting the next day, Walking Tall was my first home group, was at Castle High School in the cafeteria. So we go to the meeting, any newcomers, and I don't stand up. The guy next to me, he go, bro, you got to stand up, say you're an alcoholic. I was like, yeah, but I'm now an alcoholic. He said, you got to stand up and see him anyway. All right, ban alcoholic. I never believed I was an alcoholic and a drug addict at 20. What 20-year-old thinks that they get one problem with alcohol and drugs? It's all their fault. That's why I stay here. My father, my mother, the world, the school, everybody. It's your guys' fault. So I never know, and I stuck around. One of the things that attracted me, one of the first attractions that I had was Frank's laugh and smile. I never know how for smile like that, and I never know how for laugh like that. You know, from your gut. Oh, and he would laugh, and he's laughing at me about something that I said. He's laughing from his gut. He's not just going, hee, 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 hee. Bro, he stayed cracking up from his God laughing. I was like, bro, what you laughing about? He's like, you just gotta laugh sometimes. You know what I mean? But that was one of the attractions. And one of the other things that attracted me was that he had his family. Wife and his kids, his two daughters and his son. And bro, he was helping out tons of drunks, bro. Like, choke. All his sober livings, all the men's sober livings, full, bro, with drunks, drug addicts. Then I started finding out. He used to go downtown, go pick them up. And then if you were special, on a special day, you get to go with Frank in his van and go downtown and go help him pick up drunks and bring them home. He used to give them money. Yeah. They come back with their stuff. They shoot up in the back, and then we take them home, detox them. But that's the way it was, man. And that's the kind of stuff. And I remember this one day, probably about a week in, I got to go ride with Frank. And if you ain't go ride with Frank, but you were special, you was going to go ride with him all day. That means you never have to go work that day. Go do demolition work. And he even asked me, Ben, tell me your story. I like know about you. But I was the first guy. If I asked me about me, what would happen to Ben? He wanted to know. And the bugger would laugh at everything. I'm serious. I'm spilling my guts out. Crying, telling him all kinds of sad stories, but he's still laughing up. Freaking Frank. But that was the first time, bro, somebody ever cared enough to hear me talk. Because I know I'm a talker. I just keep everything all inside. Bury them. Keep them way down deep. And that was another attraction. When I was about 3 weeks sober, my brother Eric, the middle one, got shot and killed. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time, crossfire of a gang rivalry. He was the good one. He was the Akamai one, the smart one, good head on his shoulders, not like his older brother. And he was the one that died. You know how many times I should have went die out there and I never die? And I remember my dad showing up. No, I remember Frank going, coming, picking me up. He was like, come on, you got to go with me. And we went over to where my mom was at. And this was in Kaneohe. And we drive up, we pull up, and my dad is there. And I was like, oh, what the heck? They go, they take me inside with my mom, and they told me about my brother dying. They was all concerned that I was going to leave, that I was going to run, go get high, go get drunk. And they sat me down, and they went and walked me through that death. And Frank said one thing that stuck with me, and he was like, Ben, don't use your brother's death as an excuse to go back out. He said, use it to make you stronger. Use it to make you want to stay clean and sober. And that's what I did. At my brother's funeral, I promised him, when I went to go see him in his coffin, I promised him that I would never pick up the drink and the drug again. And I meant it. I didn't know how cunning, baffling, and powerful the disease was. But I promised him that I wouldn't drink and use anymore. And that kept me sober. I didn't admit I was an alcoholic and a drug addict. I just wasn't going to drink and use anymore because I promised him. And I stuck around. And about 30, 45 days later, my mom finally passed away of cancer. And I said the exact same thing to my mom. So in my first 90 days, I dealt with my brother's death and my mom's death. And the thing that stuck with me was what Frank told me. And I was on this pink cloud, man. There wasn't anybody that could touch me. I don't care what all those old futs in the sober living was telling me. Those old guys, you know, the 25s, the 30s, the 35s, the 40s, the 50-year-old guys. The ones used to tell me when I got in the house, they were like, "Bruh, I wouldn't spill more than you drank. You just one young punk." All those guys I had resentments against. I said, "I'll go show you." So I stayed sober on resentments. I stayed sober on promises that I made to my brother and my mom. And I said, "Screw all you guys. I'm going to show you. I'm going to be the one going to stay sober." And sure enough, nobody from my pack during that time stayed sober. And I said, "See? Told you guys." And I was one, too, that boy meets girl on AA campus. And I don't mess around when I choose the girl. She was going through one divorce. She had two kids. She was going through one divorce. And I was going to be her knight in shining armor. And I started on a mission. And I don't mess around. I mess with my sponsor's niece. I wanted to get in the family. I wanted to be one of Frank's top boys. How rolling? You can get in with Frank. You good. He take care of you. You know what I mean? Family. So her name was Stacy, and many of you who been in Alcoholics Anonymous a long time know her. And we started dating. I don't know how for date. I don't know how for have relationships. I never had one. They were all in the disease. They didn't go very well, the ones that I did have. So with Stacy, I knew that I was going to have to do some extraordinary things for keep this one. Because she was a mom of two. And I knew in my own upbringing how difficult that is, having step-parents. My dad got remarried. My mom got. They had kids, new kids. I knew about all of that. And I went after all the old timers and started looking at them and started watching what they did, how they did things with their kids and their wives. Like, I wanted to learn. I went to the old timers and started asking them questions. And I was abusive to Stacy in the beginning, verbally, a couple of times physically. And I remember going to Frank and say, "Frank, I don't know what to do." And he said, "You don't know how to argue. When you get up in the scale from 1 to 10, you, when the thing reach 1.5, you need to leave." I was like, "Bro, we didn't even start the argument." He said, "Exactly." He said, "Because you go straight from 1.5 to 10. And I started leaving. As soon as the bugger reached 1.5, gone. In the car. Going to a meeting. Going to my sponsor's house. Going to George's house. Going to whoever's house. I wait in the patio for them to come home. Back then, I never had a cell phone. So you had to drive over there. And you had to wait. People today, they don't know this stuff about sponsoring and, you know, going to any links. They pick up the phone. They can't even pick up the phone today. Bro, back when I got sober, I had to drive to their house. wait for them come home from work. That's how I got sober. You wanted this, that's what you have to do. And that's what I did. And they would teach me, and we would go to functions and all the roundups and all that kind of stuff. And Stacy wouldn't leave me. She was like, bro, you crazy. I was like, I know. And we broke up. And Frank said, you've got to get back into the program. And that's what I did. I dove back in. I'm not even 1 year sober yet. This is all in the first year. That tells you a lot about where I was at the time, man. I was a hot mess in all kinds of ways. So I started getting back, go meetings, you know, hang out with the guys, you know, doing all the stuff you're supposed to do, pray, meditate, work the steps. And then a couple months went by, and then we didn't hook up again. And we stayed together for 17 years. And we did this thing called recovery together. She had her own program. I had my own program. I had my own home group. She had her own home group. She had her own women. I had my own men. We had our own everything in the program. And that's what I was told by the old timers, was that I need to work my program. She need to work her program. And hopefully, maybe you guys can stand together as pillars in your own sobriety, so you guys not leaning on each other. You guys actually can stand together as one. And that's what I was taught by the old timers. And that's what we did. And it wasn't until I had about just over a year. Oh, I got to tell you guys my first birthday story. Bro, this is on classic. So because I'm in with Frank, all the boys, I thought, guarantee, I seen this happen, get luau's. We used to cook for plenty luau's, Frank, and the guys. So I was like, oh, because I in with Frank, I'm dating his niece, I'm taking care of his niece and nephew, he can at least throw me my luau. So I'm waiting, January, yeah, my birthday coming up. I'm waiting. I was like, oh, wow, these guys know how to keep one secret, man. I never know. I was like, wow. See, yeah, how the hell I never hear about the luau? Well, at that time, Franklin started up on treatment center up in Makikilo, up in the boonies, in the woods, called A Second Chance. And I was working up there as a driver. Frank comes working, come walking into the office. We went candle, I went cupcake, I went candle. He come walk up to me and he said, happy birthday, and if you're here for fucking parties, you're in the wrong fucking place. I was like, oh, brother. No more luau. No more luau. Cupcake, I went candle. So from that point on, no more luau expectations. All I expected was a cupcake and a candle. For 29 years, that's all I wished for. Cupcake and one candle on my birthday. But I still never think and believe and decided that I was an alcoholic and a drug addict yet. So I started because I knew everything. And because I was one of Frank's boys, and I was dating the niece, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, thought I was somebody, I started going doing 12-step calls by myself. You're not supposed to do that, right? No, not supposed to do that. But don't you know who I am? And I started going to old drug dealer friends of mine. I go and save them and bring them into the program. I seen Frank do them. I can do them too. You know what I mean? Did them plenty times. First time, go, oh, how's everything? Good. Yeah, yeah. Okay, leave. Go back second time. Oh, I can see your stuff. Oh, wow. Oh, long time no see that. Leave. Come back third time. Oh, I can see the pipe and the lighter and all that. Had that in hand, ready to get high at about 14 months of sobriety, of recovery. And that lady, she took the stuff away from me and said, get the hell out of here. You're doing too good. It was that day that I realized that no matter how much I promised my brother and my mom that I wasn't going to drink and use again, no matter how much resentments I had, I knew at that point how cunning, baffling, and powerful the disease of alcoholism and drug addiction really was. And it was that day that Ben decided that I was an alcoholic and a drug addict. And I needed to seriously figure out what the hell was broken. And I started digging into the program, man. I started calling sponsor, getting into step studies, big book studies, service. I was on a mission. And that hasn't stopped since. I realized today at 29 years of sobriety that the most important step for me and the only one that I got to buy every day 100% is step one. Complete defeat. I got to admit that to myself every single day. That I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. And that's what I do. I don't forget. I know how unmanageable and how powerlessness works and was for me in my disease and even in my recovery. And I just started on this mission. I started working in the field, a second chance. Around that time, Franklin asked me if I was interested in being a counselor. I said, yeah, I'm 21 years old, but I'm going to go counsel people now. I told you guys how good I was. And just kidding. So the first client that Frank gave me was this like 40-year-old, convicted felon, criminal, hardcore drug addict on the streets. That's who he didn't give me as my first client. I was so intimidated. And his name was Paul. You know that guy who introduced me tonight? Paul was my first client. I never do a good enough job because he went back out. But he came back into the rooms. And we started to become friends in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. At 3 years sober, my mom, one of the things that my mom had left me was I was on the Hawaiian Homestead list for Get Homestead. And I got selected for a community in Nanakuli called Princess Kahanu. And I bought my first home at 3 years of sobriety. Bro, the house was only $120,000. That was big money for me, bro, 3 years sober. And I was still plugged into the program. That woman, Stacy, we moved in together. I became dad to Jonah and Lena. A lot of you guys know them. They were just 4 and 2 when I met their mom. Lena is deaf. Had a lot of sicknesses when she was baby, a lot of surgeries, spent a lot of days at the hospital with her, taking care of her, along with the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Jonah was an athlete and was always good at sports. And I watched you guys, the old timers in the program, I watched you guys do that with your kids, and I just kept copying what you guys was doing. I never have to say nothing, I just needed to be there, they said. Ben, just go and be there for your kids. Just show up. My parents never showed up. I never know how to show up. So I learned how to just show up. And those kids grew up, and I finally got, you know, one of the things for me as a local boy was you get one state, city job, you get one house, you get your family, that was it. You're good for life. I got that state job working for the Department of Public Safety here in the prisons up at a program called Cashbox. And I was there for 12 years working with convicted felons. Until today, I still run across a lot of those guys. A lot of those guys are still in my life today. And I stayed there for 12 years. We lived in Nanakuli. We was involved in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, big time convention, roundups, campouts, you name it. We was doing it. When me and Stacy first met, early on, I wanted to have kids right away. And she convinced me that not to. And I understood. She said, you know, if we start having kids, I don't like you neglect mine. And I said, okay, I understand that. I was neglected. I know what that's all about. We'll go wait. Some years go by, 10 years go by, I start going, I like to start having some children of my own. And we went on this journey for about 7 years of this back and forth. And I found out that my wife, Stacy, didn't want to have kids anymore. And she couldn't have kids. So what was Ben going to do? I stayed in the marriage and we stayed together, living happily ever after in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and being involved and all that good stuff. And at about year 15, we went through in vitro, all kinds of stuff, me and her. At year 15, I found out that me and her went over to my mom's family's house for Easter Sunday. And my mom's sister, she goes, how are you, Benny? You okay? Yeah. I'm good. She goes, you know your father, not your father, eh? I was like, what? I'm named after my father. What you talking about? I'm the third. She's like, yeah, that's not your father. I proceeded to ask, so who's my father? They said his name is Paul. And I was like, Paul who? They said his last name. And I was just like, nah. I said, I know Paul. Paul is my good friend. In Alcoholics Anonymous, I was his counselor. I said, frick. I called my father. I said, Dad, this is what Auntie just went telling me. He all pissed off. Yeah, what the hell? She's stupid or what? Da, da, da. And my father got sober when my brother died. He stopped drinking. So this is about year 15 of my sobriety. I call him up. He said, what? I said, you knew about this? He goes, no. So I don't know then. So the next call, my father, I knew something was off with the dates. But this is what went happen. My mom, when she got pregnant, she had my father for choose from and Paul for choose from at the time, I guess. I don't know what was going on. She decided to choose my dad to be my dad. Had me, they got married. My father was in Alaska working on the fishing boats. She didn't call him and said, I pregnant with your baby. You got to come home. He came home as a good Hawaiian man, married my mom, had two more kids. Nobody taught anything. Until 15 years in my sobriety, 35 years old, out of the blue, Auntie got to tell me he not my father. Why? I don't know. Still don't know. So the next phone call, I call Paul. I go, Paul, you know somebody named Inga? Told him my mom's last name. He go, I never hear that name. Long time. I You know who that is? Yeah, yeah, yeah. I said, well, bro, this is what I just was told. He goes, bro, you're my son. I said, I guess so, bro. So I asked Paul. Paul, you was ever intimate with my mom? He goes, yeah. I said, well, there's a pretty good chance, bro. You're my father. I went through quite a process with that. That one threw me for a loop. A few loops. I was just in the middle, me and my wife, trying to figure out this kid thing. Here I am. I don't know who my father now. Screwing me all up. 15 years of sobriety. What the hell? Took me some time. Me and my father went to do a DNA test, confirmed that he wasn't my biological father. Broke my dad's heart. At the end of it all, my dad, he go, I don't care. I said, you my son. And that's all I needed to hear. And I made the decision that I was going to keep things exactly the way it was. Paul was always going to be Paul. My dad was always going to be my dad. And me and Paul started on this new journey of knowing that he was my biological father. I'm sorry, Paul. But I told you my family was screwed up. You see why I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous? Nobody can script this. Hollywood can't even come up with this kind of story. I think after this, they're going to send the recording to a director in Hollywood or something. Try to tell the story. And wait, not Paul yet. Get better. So, I made a decision. My son had graduated from high school. He was off in Fresno in college. My daughter was 18, graduating from Pearl City High School. I made a decision that it was time for me to move on. And I asked my wife for a divorce. Whew. During the time that we were separated, I worked in Nanakuli. My house is in Nanakuli. I used to go drive to my dad's house because I had moved out of the house. Let Stacy stay at the house with the kids. And there's one day she had called the office asking if I was coming home. And I said, yeah, I got to come home, pick up some clothes, and then I'm going to go to dad's. Something came up and I never go. I went straight to my dad's. And a couple hours later, I got a call from my neighbor crying on the phone telling me, Ben, you got to come home. And I was like, what the hell is going on? I said, just come home. Something went happen with Stacy. So I sped to Nanakuli from town in my truck, passing cops, passing cars. I had about 5 cops following me all the way to my house in Nanakuli. I never care. My wife had hung herself in our garage and died. And that through us and everybody who was involved in our life, including the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, into some turmoil, man. There was a lot of blame, a lot of anger, a lot of hurt, a lot of pain. And that had changed our lives forever. And that was a big learning lesson. I found out who my true friends were during that time. The men of Alcoholics Anonymous didn't leave my side. I had men sleeping in my house at 17 years of sobriety, walking through that death. And my kids, Jonah and Lena, we just stayed tight. We walked through it together. And things moved on. The thing that stayed consistent and stable for 17 years of my sobriety at that point was the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You were the only thing that I knew best and had walked me through all kinds of stuff. And I knew where to go, and it was here. And I just continued to stay plugged in. No matter what was being said, no matter what people was telling me, no matter how angry people was, I just showed up anyway. And those members that didn't want to be a part of my life anymore, you know what? Alcoholics Anonymous, big. Get plenty of fellowship. I let them go. I move on. I find new friends in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the ones that wanted to stay in my life, they stayed in my life. And it was hard. After she died and time kind of went on, I was single. I had done some pretty crazy things during this time. Remember now, I wasn't good at dating. Somewhat good at relationships at that point. And I just started, I was on a mission to have kids. I was looking for victims. I never care who. And as an old timer at 17 years of sobriety, 18 years of sobriety at the time, I did a lot of wrong things during that period of time. Made some really bad choices and decisions during that time. Created a lot of pain for myself and for others during that time. But one thing that stayed consistent was the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just kept plugging away. And I finally got tired of it. I got sick of doing what I was doing, trying to look. Me and my sponsor, we used to meet. I used to try and come up with criterias. Oh, okay, she got to be local girl. Okay, she got to know for dance hula. Okay, she got to have good job, maybe no kids. And I went on this mission trying to find that. Epic fail. In many ways. And it wasn't until Ben had stopped, at about 20 years of sobriety, I was working for this private rehab center in Hawaii Kai, and the admissions person lived in California. And she said, you know what, I'll go find you a job. You like work California? I was like, okay, yeah. So she hooked me up. We went job in Corona Del Mar, Newport Beach, California, for a private rehab center, high-end. Clients that come inside, they pay $25,000, $30,000 cash a month. Yeah, high end. And I moved. I left my house in Nanakuli, moved to California. Said I was going to start new. And I did. I had a great job, man. That was an amazing experience. Moving to California was one of the best things that ever happened to me. You know, this special ed kid that was stupid and dumb. When I was 10 years sober, I wanted to advance myself in my career. But I couldn't because I didn't have a degree. My sponsor said, well, looks like you're going to have to go college. I was like, yeah, but I can't do college. I don't do school. He said, the same thing you did in the program is the same thing you do in school. One assignment at a time, one sentence at a time, one word at a time, one class at a time. And next thing you know, boom, 120 credits later, bachelor's degree. Ho, Akamai. Bro, this kid who thought he was stupid and dumb actually was smart. Got my bachelor's degree, the counselor came and said, oh, we got one deal. Go into your master's program. Oh, shoot. Year and a half later, ho, master's degree. Ho, even more Akamai now. Now I get MBA after my name. Then after I did that one, I started falling in love with education. The thing that I was deadly afraid of because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I started doing. I started falling in love with it. It started to expand my mind in ways that I could never, ever imagine. I was so stuck in my own little circle and bubble that I couldn't see the world. And that's what education gave me, was a vision to see the world. And I wanted to do new things. And I wanted to try new things. And so after that master's degree, I went into my doctorate degree. And did that. The only thing I have to do in that doctorate degree is do my dissertation. And I'd be a doctor. This special ed kid. Anything is possible in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous if we make our sobrieties number one. And during all of that time, during the relationship, the marriage, the kids, the job, AA and everything, I stayed plugged in always. My home group, Malia Discussion, Wednesday Night Men's Stag, I was always plugged into my program. That had never stopped. Never. Till today, this is my lifeblood. This is how I live. You guys are the reasons why I'm here today. The rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I've been living in California. That job that brought me up there, I was the program director of. And a few months in, I needed to hire a therapist. Started interviewing therapists. And this one therapist came highly recommended by a colleague of mine. And so I set up the interview. She comes. I go upstairs to the front door. I open up the black door. There's this tall, but she was taller than me. She had heels on. And she was beautiful. I was like, ho. What if she get the job? She did good in the interview. We asked her back. Me and the clinical director asked her back for the second interview. Between the time of the first interview and when we were supposed to do the second interview, she called me, left one message, I think, and said she decided not to take the job and not to do the second interview. Inside, bro, I was like, yeah. She never take the job. I call her back. Oh, what happened? She started telling me all the story and all that kind of stuff. And I said, oh, that's good. That's good. I go, I can take you out to dinner. She started laughing. She didn't giggle. She's like, you asking me out on a date? I was like, yep. She goes, oh, let me get back with you. I was like, oh, that's not a good sign, right? I had some experience dating, enough to know that probably wasn't a good sign. So I call her back and I said, how's about just a cup of coffee? Make them less pressure, you know what I mean? Cup of coffee, you know? She goes, okay, I call you when I'm on my way back from Whittier. I was like, oh, what is that, Whittier? She's like, that's not what is that, that's one city, Whittier. Still new to California, you know what I mean? So we meet at one Starbucks. She came, she showed up. And that was January 7th. That was our first date. We closed down Starbucks. Just talking story, you know what I mean? And she go, oh, we go down Balboa. Go find one fire pit. Maybe we go sit down, continue talking. Okay, yeah. Go down. She take me down. Bro, was meant to be. We pull up into this place, had fire pits, bro. Nobody there. Get one fire pit, big fire, like somebody came, went light them for us and left. We still looking around. Wow, no more nobody over here. So we go sit down by the fire. Continue talking. Bro, we just didn't hit it off, I guess. Maybe. I would ask her if I could kiss her that night. I don't mess around, bro. The only thing she could say was no. So it was either going to be yes or it was going to be no. I can handle the no. And she said yes, and that was our first kiss. From that day on, we haven't been apart. I tell you, I don't mess around. The next day, I go meet her. She was going to go have her hair done. I meet her, bring Starbucks coffee, hang out, meet her hairstylist. Meeting the hairstylist is a big thing, you know. If you guys don't know this, I'm going to let you know now. That's one of the people you got to meet to get approval. Not the father, not the mother, the hairstylist. Met the hairstylist. Oh, we're doing good now. She asked me to go out that night, company party. We go out. And then I asked her that night, I said, oh, I had planned one trip for come back Hawaii in 2 weeks. I go, you like come with me? Day two now, okay? Already asking her for come back home with me. I said, we can book the flight right now. Go on the computer. She said, okay. Tells you a lot about her, eh? She just didn't fall in love with me instantly, that's why. She said, yeah, we booked the flight. 2 weeks later, we come home. Just so happened, we had 3 luaus for go that weekend. 2 the first day. She met the whole Kaneakala clan and then some. 2 weeks into the relationship, I said, oh, babe, one thing you got to learn. You got to learn how to say my last name correctly because they're going to ask you. It's one of the tests. Sure enough, my mother, you know how to say our last name? She did them. We in practice. Local boy, I know. You got to prep them. You know what I mean? And she hit it off, man, with the family. 3 months later, she gets pregnant. I told you, bro. I work fast. Come on. Remember, I was on this mission for 20 years at that point, trying to have kids. You guys don't even know the lengths I went. The things I had to do for 20 years for finally get pregnant. Well, my wife got pregnant, but you know what I mean. And I had my first daughter, Phoenix is her name. About the happiest day of my life. I finally had my own child. With all the opala and everything that went on, and all the father, daddy stuff and everything that went on, bro. This was huge. I cuddled that baby, bro. I sleep with the baby, like on my chest, like breathing her mouth. You know, make the, you know, the breath of life. You know what I mean? Oh, I was all spiritual. Me and my daughter connecting, you know, at levels that are unknown to man. I take her swimming classes because she got to know the ocean. She got to know how to swim. Was in my pool, bro. Wasn't in the ocean. Take her every weekend, bro. Teach my daughter how to swim in a swimming pool. Did that for almost 3 years, bro. Faithfully take that girl. I wanted to be the best freaking dad that I could ever be. Everything that I had gone through in that first 20 years of life, man, I just wanted to just throw it right into her and give her a life that I had never lived. Give her something different. And that's what me and my wife have been able to do. And I continued working in the field of drug addiction up there in California. And finally, after when Phoenix was 3, we got pregnant again and had my second daughter. Her name is Fate. P-H-A-I-T. And those two girls, man, are the love of my life and my wife and my 3 women. And 3 years ago, me and my wife decided that I was getting tired of working for other people. I wanted to use the experience that I had at 25 years of sobriety and my education to start up my own treatment center. So I started my own treatment center in California 3 years ago called Phoenix Rising. Humble beginnings, just me. Me and my little office about 8x8. I did all the counseling, all the groups, all the intakes, all the admissions. I did everything for like freaking 6 months. Charging away, you know what I mean? I get this, I'm going to do them, you know? No more money, barely keeping them alive. And about a year and a half of us being open, ended up with 6 offices in this space, and we had grown a little bit. And then the place that I was at said, bro, you gotta leave. We cannot have your kind in our space. So I went out looking for an office space, and about a year and a half ago, we've got our own office space. No need to worry about nobody. And about over a year ago, right when we moved in, my wife moved to private practice. My wife's a psychologist and licensed marriage and family therapist and is my clinical director of our treatment center. She more Akamai than me. I thought I was Akamai until I met her. Smart wahine, this one. She no more just 1 doctorate. No, she got to go after 2 doctorates. And now we get sober livings. I get my own treatment center. We're in the process of opening up a mental health residential treatment center in Orange County. And we're doing okay. A few months ago, I just started to get to know Paul's sister in Chicago, Paula. Started connecting with some of the family, Paul's family, you know. We stay in contact through Facebook and, you know, see each other every now and then and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, me and Paul just was meant to be from the first time we met 29 years ago. One day I was talking to Paula on the phone and Paula goes, oh, you know, you get 1 sister and a couple half-brothers, eh? I was like, yeah, I know. Paul Jr., somebody else, one daughter. And she said, oh, CPS went call for, see if me or Paul wanted to take the baby, for adopt the baby. My sister, my half-sister, had one baby that was taken at the hospital into foster care. And CPS had finally called them and asked if family wanted to take the baby, and they said no. So when I found out about it, it's something that me and my wife wanted to do was we wanted to adopt. I wanted to provide a home to a foster kid. So I went on this mission. I called CPS, said I'm her half brother, and I'm interested in adopting this kid. So one of the things, because we never have proof that Paul was our biological father, one of the things that I had to do by the CPS was I needed to I had decided that I was gonna go do a DNA test with me and Paul. And about a month ago I got the results back of the DNA test. And Paul isn't my biological father. So for the past month, I'm looping again. I don't know what to tell you guys, bro. I'm still trying to figure this one out. For 15 years, me and Paul have been working on this father-son relationship. I told you gonna get better. Nobody saw that one coming, eh, bro? I never see that one coming either. We thought it was on slam dunk with the DNA test. I'm going to show CPS. Boop. We're going to be in the system. We're going to be able to get the baby. You know what I mean? Nope. Shut down. Call CPS. Tell them sorry. Made a mistake. I love Paul. What are you supposed to do with this kind of information? Only in sobriety, bro. Can this stuff happen? You know what I mean? So I'm keeping it the way that it was. My dad is my dad. Paul is Paul. And for my own sanity, that's just the way it's going to be. I get way too much stuff going on in my life right now with the kids and my wife and the companies and everything that's going on in our life. And for right now, the way things are, I'm just keeping it the way it is. And I don't know if it's going to change. I like know who my biological father is. I really do. It's a sad thing. For somebody who doesn't know who their biological father is, it's a sad thing. It's not happy. I don't know how I'm going to find out. My mom died. She took this to her grave. Maybe she never knew. Maybe she knew. I don't know. All I know is that I got my sobriety. I got Alcoholics Anonymous. I got my meetings, my home group, my sponsor, Carl, who's been my sponsor my entire freaking life in sobriety. I got prayer and meditation, sponsorship, service. And that's all that I know. And I have two beautiful children. And a beautiful wife. And for an alcoholic like me, I shouldn't have any of that. So if it wasn't for you in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't have what I have today. Ho. Well, that went by fast. I don't know about you, but that went by fast. One of the mantras or the things that I had been told when I first got sober and working with the family was those three mottos at the end of the chapter. First things first, my sobriety. Do what I gotta do. Live and let live. Allow them to do and to live the way that they need to and not try and control them. And brother, easy does it. I made my own thing up when I was early on sobriety, when I was learning how to do this relationship thing with Stacy. I used to hate going shopping. My sponsor would go, "You go and you just push the wagon. You know, say nothing, you know, do nothing. You just push the wagon, follow your wife around the store." Yes, sponsor. Push the wagon. Oh, but I hated it. Hated going to the shopping, to the store. Grocery shopping, shopping, any kind of shopping. Push the wagon. Till today, gotta push the wagon. But one of the things I found out by pushing the wagon, get plenty out of departments. Get the automotive department. Get the electronics department. Bro, get places for me for go in the shopping center. So I started discovering new things just by pushing a wagon. So when it comes to family, push the wagon. Especially the guys. Don't say nothing. Just go push the wagon. Be a good partner and shut up. And don't say nothing. Happy wife, happy life. You guys got to learn this, bro. These are very important family afterwards mantras. I'm telling you. Serious stuff, man. It'll change your life. And I thank you guys for allowing me to be here at this 57th annual convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank Alberta for having me here and for having me. And I just want to tell you guys, mahalo. And thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.